This week in the studio, it's U2, the best of 1980 to 1990, part two.
We feel more determined than ever to follow that through, that thought that, you know, that music can actually change, if not change the world, change the temperature of the world. In the 80s, which this best of is based in, there were easier, you know, more determinable bad guys. And we were having a go at them, but it's the same. I'd like to think it's the same righteous anger.
In 1980, the Irish quartet U2 became apparent with the song I Will Follow from their debut. With their third album, War, U2 became significant to a growing fan base. With the song Pride in the Name of Love in 1984, U2 became important as musical messengers for changing times marked by Live Aid and the Conspiracy of Hope tour to benefit Amnesty International. After 1987's album The Joshua Tree, U2 became recognized as the most popular band in the world while maintaining its reputation as one of the most adventurous. With superstardom requiring more of their time be spent touring and now recording in the U.S., the band members of U2 were confronted with Reagan-era America in the mid to late 80s. It was often at odds with images with which Bono and the others had grown up from American movies and television.
The U.S. is a different place for Irish people than, say, English people. English people are just jealous that they're no longer an empire. And they're so pissed off with the U.S. So that's their problem. We go there, we just had the best time of our life. I couldn't believe to be in these cities, like to be in Chicago, to be walking around Chicago where this music had come from, to be in Memphis, to be even Los Angeles, you know, just this whole, just, you know, an entire, you know, county of swimming pools.
It actually felt like home because the Irish had built it.
But it was just, we had this love affair with the country, but at the same time, we could see that this dream that we'd all bought into was really starting to fray at the edges. And we could see that the big ideas of America were being shrunk by the minute. And we could see after, you know, Watergate and Vietnam, and now that they're beating up Nicaragua and El Salvador, it was all getting a bit sour. And that's why for the Joshua Tree, we chose a desert as that image. Because this place that we loved, that's what it turned and had turned into in the 80s. Right in the middle of its most successful time on Wall Street, when people were, you know, shoveling countries up their nose, and there was just this vast material wealth. It seemed like a desert to us.
I wanna take shelter from the poison.
Originally from 1987's The Joshua Tree album, that's U2 with Where the Streets Have No Name. As is often the case when someone creates a masterpiece, U2's singer and lyricist Bono was ambivalent about what they'd made.
I just remember when we finished that album, myself and Larry went off together to the Caribbean. It was a big trip for us. And we went to Chris Blackwell, who owned Island Records and brought Bob Marley to the world, etc.
Bahamas.
There it was. Okay, the Bahamas. Yeah. And we went there, and I remember thinking, this is like Butlins for Millionaires or something. We were like, phew, what's all this? But having a great time, couldn't believe it, being looked after, and so depressed about that record.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't play it for about 5 days, then we played it, and we just both looked at each other and was just like, man, we really... It's always the same, isn't it? And then I said, yeah, let's just not put it on. We're going to ruin this trip. So we just put it away, never listened to it again. We were that depressed about it.
the first of two number one hits from the Joshua Tree album. That's U2's With or Without You. Guitarist The Edge echoes Bono's uncertainty on whether U2 had done their best on the Joshua Tree.
I remember feeling that we had a few really strong tunes on the album, all right. I think we all recognized that With or Without You and Still Love and Famine Are Looking For were great tunes. But I actually remember feeling a little disappointed that we hadn't managed to push up some of the other tunes, the ones kind of on side two, and that I left feeling that we could have made an even better record.
It was beaten up pretty badly in the UK, and we're living in Ireland, so it's next door, so it depends. I mean, it's funny, records, you know, albums are reviewed completely differently on different continents. Rattlin' Hum was reviewed really well in the UK and killed in the US. Joshua Tree was great in the US, really bad in the UK. So, you know, you had a few thumps, a few punches. But only recently now have I realised that it is a very special record. But at the time, we were always, every night when we played on the road, we were trying to remake it and get it right. It's the truth.
You.
another number one song from 1987's The Joshua Tree. That's U2 with I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For. Coming up next, Bono and The Edge reveal how the stark black and white imagery on the Joshua Tree's cover was chosen to represent Reagan-era America, and how their private home movie grew into a major motion picture and soundtrack. I'm Redbeard in the studio with Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductees U2 for the best of the 80s. I'm Redbeard. The Joshua Tree album by U2 won two Grammy Awards, including the prestigious Album of the Year Grammy. The massive tour to support the album's release found sold-out arenas everywhere, often multiple nights in each city. In an interview with Louis Largent, The Edge and Bono remember a loose plan for filming some of the tour.
The whole idea was that we were coming to the end of the Joshua Tree tour. We had this movie we were shooting, and it was really at the end of all that 2 years of madness. We wanted just to put out a movie that would go into maybe half a dozen cinemas across America, really small, and maybe there'd be an album which would be a kind of scrapbook of, you know, moments from the tour. Boy, did we get that wrong. Somehow that plan just ran away with itself.
It was our fault. We actually agreed to that. In the end we signed up for the mega thing, and it did our heads in. But Edge is exactly right.
But that wasn't the plan.
That wasn't the original plan.
What actually happened, and it's, we started funding the film ourselves. That's right. Actually what happened. Suddenly we realized that we, from starting to make a small film, suddenly we'd actually spent a very large budget, and it was a case of one wouldn't go into the other, so we had to rethink the plan.
Take the staircase. first floor. We turn the key and slowly unlock the door. As the man breathes into his saxophone, and through the walls you hear the city groan. Outside it's America. Outside it's America.
One of the places that appeared to be an oasis for U2 was Memphis, Tennessee, the cradle of rock and roll. Having grown up with the legends of Sun Studio, people like Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, and Johnny Cash, the members of U2 visited the actual Sun Studio while on tour in Memphis. Here's The Edge.
Great room. Great room. Amazing sounding room. The funny thing about Sun Studios is we got there with Cowboy Jack Clemons. Walked into the room, which was at that point had just been taken over and made a studio again. It was a battery repair shop for like 15 years. And Bono said to Cowboy Jack, who'd actually been an engineer on some of the Elvis sessions, you know, hey, you know, how did you get that Elvis vocal sound? And Cowboy said, hey, well, we used this old mic, one like just like that one. And he pulled out this old mic that was in the corner. He says, well, and we just put it there and then set it up, bit of slapback tape echo. And next thing, Bono's like singing through this microphone. And it was unbelievable. It was eerie. The sound that came out was like the sound that we all know from those records. And it's in the bricks and mortar. It's in that room.
U2 guitarist The Edge pointed out that their movie soundtrack, Rattle and Hum, was a musical bookend for the 80s.
I think when we made Achtung Baby, it was very important for us as a group. You know, I think it was actually important for our survival as a group, because I think we had kind of got to the end of a certain road with Rattle and Hum. And so I would say the 90s work, starting with Achtung Baby, was definitely a new beginning for us. And not that at the time I felt there was anything that we ought to have changed about what we'd done in the 80s, but it had definitely run its course. So for us it was a definite decision to go in a different direction.
From 2004's album, How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb, that's triple Grammy winner Vertigo with an amazing video. In an interview with Lewis Largent in their home of Dublin, U2 guitarist The Edge and singer Bono were asked to identify the biggest differences between U2 then and now. The Edge answers first in the studio.
Irony, I think. Discovering that we could approach a subject round the back rather than head on, I would say that's probably the biggest difference.
I think we're a much cooler band, but I'm not sure that's good. And now that everybody thinks, you know, that we're okay to have around the house, I actually look back on the 80s and I think these were great moments. We were daring, and we had no sense of cool whatsoever. We were Irish. We're from Dublin. We didn't know how to look, how to dress. You know, we didn't even stand. You know, it was just, we were so far removed from the culture of rock and roll. In the 90s, we actually figured it out, and we learned how to get at the same subject matter, as Ed was saying, from a different rooting. And we made some cool, we played some cool shows, made some great records in the 90s, and we're not over yet. We're going to make our best record next year. But I still think now, for the first time I could say this, in last year I couldn't say that, there was genuine bravery and boldness to what we did in the 80s, and we got a lot of stick for it. And I guess if me now, if I was who I am now back in the 80s, I'd have been dishing out the stick, but I'd have been wrong.
Because of You from 2004's How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb. Amazingly, you can draw a straight line musically and lyrically from I Will Follow to All Because of You. Scant few bands can even survive that long, let alone stay true to their musical heading. Yet even with U2's induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame on the first ballot, U2's motives are being questioned by some. I'm not broke, but you can see the cracks, sings Bono in All Because of You. But as early as 1988's God Part II, Bono was quick to indict himself over the contradictions of their newly found international superstardom after the Joshua Tree. If a small group of people set out on a journey in a straight line, headed for the horizon, eventually they'll arrive back home, facing the same direction. Only a view from the heavens above would reveal that straight line path to be, in actuality, a circle. So the perception of U2's long journey relies solely on your perspective, either worldly or heavenly. I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking The Edge and Bono for their insights into the music. Special thanks this time to Louis Largent, Mark Felsot, and to Paul McGinnis. You can write to us in the studio. Email to redbeard@inthestudio.net. In the Studio was written this edition by yours truly, transcription by Jane Carpenter, theme song by Andy Timmons. In the Studio is produced by Barbarossa Limited. Copyright 2005, all rights reserved.